if your brand's big enough, I don't necessarily think you need to remind people during the World Series or the Super Bowl.
You know, when we started that first year, you know, maybe button color and button placement really mattered.
The current model wants to see this hockey stick.
The incumbents in a lot of these industries are 10, 20, 50 years old. Their R&D budget is bigger than your operating budget.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Results Junkies podcast. You know, we ended last week talking about the acquisition that wasn't meant to be, and we start the week talking about DME. And, you know, Paul, I'm going to say, like, I read all the tweets that you had this past week, but I'm a little bit lost on what Bump is actually trying to track down right now.
Yeah, so first off, the definition DME just means durable medical equipment. And that's sort of just a category, one of many categories of, interesting businesses that I think need to be disrupted. I'll give you a personal example of what a DME business is, and then maybe that'll help you, you know, kind of understand what it is. So when you go to the doctor and the doctor says, hey, you need a crutch, whether it's a walker or a crutch or whatever, that is an example of durable medical equipment. And in many cases, that durable medical equipment, that, let's just use that walker as an example, sometimes that's covered under your health insurance coverage. And so, so DME is sort of this like broad category of things that generally are provided by your insurance or could be covered by your insurance. So let me pause there. Does that kind of help?
Yeah, no, it helps a lot. Because you guys are talking about trying to attack this. And I think I saw your tweet about the EpiPen and like, I can't imagine those things are $5,000.
So that's just it, man. That's one of many examples that made me want to like go down this path. So let me just kind of replay the example here for anybody listening to this. So my youngest had a adverse reaction to peanuts. He's 8 months old at the time. So we take him down to the doctor. Doctor says, hey, listen, we can't do a full panel for a couple months. He's got to be a little older. But hey, here's an EpiPen. I'll just go ahead and send it with you now. No problem. Don't worry about it. You know, it makes me feel good. It's great. Great, great, great. Now, the good news is I never got charged for it, right? He says it was covered by insurance and he was correct. But actually what ended up happening was that, you know, for those of you that have dealt with your own insurance, you know that you'll get an explanation of benefits, like an EOB document mailed to you that says, hey, here's something we paid for you on your behalf, and here's how much you owe. And 9 times out of 10, it says you owe $0, and it tells you how much the doctor got paid or the vendor got paid. In this particular case, because my youngest is an infant, the EpiPen is very small. It's the size of a pack of cards, and presumably it's not a custom thing. I mean, you know, EpiPens are a lot of people use them. Anyway, the point of it is, I got the EOB in the mail the other day, and the good news is it didn't cost me anything. It said your cost is $0, but it said that the vendor had charged my insurance $4,800. Now, there was some change, and you can go on my social and see the exact dollars. The point of it is, if that wasn't absurd enough, the fact is they got paid that amount too. So Aetna paid it, which, I mean, that's like insane to me. That's not the only place it happens. You see that happen with, pharmacies. You see that happen with even doctor's visits. You know, you'll have a kid and you go look at the EOB for that. It'll be like, you know, your cost, $500 a night. Billed to insurance, $27,000. We paid $23,000. And you're like, what in the world? And I know I'm rambling, but I'll just end it by saying this. The more and more I started looking into what in the world was happening with those EOBs, the more and more, like, it just felt weird. Basically, and anybody in the DME space, you're going to hate me for saying it this way, but I'm going to just simplify it for everybody else. Basically, the DME racket is to charge as much as you can without getting the claim rejected by the payer and settling for whatever. So you know you're not going to have 100% acceptance of your claims. So like if you're a doctor's office or if you're a, you know, DME company, you know you're not going to get paid for 100% of all the claims you submit. So the game, in a nutshell, is to figure out how much to overcharge the payers without making your denial rate get too big. So in other words, if you could get 20% of your, and I'm just going to use illustrative examples. If you can get 50% of your claims paid back to you from the insurance cover, provider at 2x what you charged, then you've made money on this, right? You're just fine. And that's the whole game. Anyway, I'm getting fired up because the more I dug into it, the more shady it is, and I want to redo it.
Yeah, and I think, so I think taking a step back, like I think this is, like we see this so often when we're on the road of, you know, this is how companies get started, is solving a pain point that somebody else had. And in this case, you didn't necessarily have the pain point, but you're looking down at this inefficiency. And, you know, my mother-in-law carries an EpiPen, and I don't know that I'll get the numbers exactly right, but I want to say that, and this is an adult EpiPen, so maybe infant EpiPens are like some crazy separate, you know, regulated thing. But like, I want to say that she pays like a few hundred bucks for one. And so we're looking at, you know, whatever the insurance company was billed here was likely probably 10x what this thing should cost. Because like maybe an infant one costs more because of the, it'd be more regulated, more oversight, whatever. But I think like the high level 10,000 foot comment I'd make is like, this is how companies get started. Because you look at a problem and say like, I can't stand this, I need to fix it for myself. And then you find, you know, as you always say when we're on the road, you find 10 people to pay you for that. And then you find 100 people to pay you for that. And I guess we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. I'll, you know, frame up what we're, what Paul and I are going to try and cover today on the show. I think, you know, this was definitely part of it because I think it's a, just a huge, huge space for you guys to tackle. We definitely want to dig into some of the North Star updates that you have coming because I'm hoping one of them is going to work for me. I definitely want to talk more about growth. You and I were talking offline and I think we've got a great discussion on how hard it is to grow nowadays. And then, you know, maybe touch on some other big companies that we see that are falling over based on Apple's changes in the new OS and targeting. For folks who are listening in, if you are listening and you like the show, make sure you hit the subscribe button wherever you're listening. You can shoot us questions, show@resultsjunkies.com. And you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. He is at Paul Singh. I am at Pizza in Motion. So I sit here, Paul, and I look at this, and I know, you know, my mother-in-law has been using EpiPens for decades, and I just, I still struggle with the fact, how do $5,000 EpiPens still exist today? How come somebody hasn't come in and filled this void?
Well, I think that there's still a lot of industries that have yet to be really disrupted by technology. So when you look at, for example, the DME space, and let's just use DME as an illustration of a lot of other industries out there, including things like construction and restaurants or whatever else. I think that there are three things that tend to hold innovation back or entrepreneurship back in those things. Like why is DME so hard? Well, it's because number one, not a lot of tech people or tech enabled or tech oriented people enter those industries. Number two, there's not a lot of capital available to start something. So you've got to either know something, have some money, have some way to get started. But these are like hard businesses to be in because there's regulatory hurdles and moats like that that you have to overcome. And then I think the third reason why there's not a lot of innovation there is because the incumbents are just so massive. So massive that, you know, if you're, let's just say you did happen to be lucky enough to be able to raise some money in the DME space. And let's say you did have the tech chops to know how to build for that industry today. Well, you're still thinking on quarterly timelines because you raised money and you probably only have a year to maybe 2 years of runway in the bank. The incumbents in a lot of these industries are 10, 20, 50 years old. Their R&D budget is bigger than your operating budget. There's a lot of this out there. You've heard me say a million times that I think the biggest money to be made over the next 10 years is at the intersection of online and offline. And I really mean it. There's so many of these air quotes offline businesses out there that have yet to be disrupted. And I think there's a lot of opportunity for entrepreneurs over the next 10 years and for investors there.
Well, yeah, I think back to, and I think we talked about this on a previous show, but I think it ties back to the company that we saw in St. Louis that wanted to build a better breast pump. And, you know, certainly their hurdles were more FDA related, but there was significant disruption in that space. And I think, you know, if you were to try and tackle DME, and I think, you know, I don't know where how Bump will try and chew this, but it sort of goes back to our comment about eating an elephant one bite at a time. And you know, I look at this and say, you know, hey, is there a way if you really can still bill insurance companies $5,000 a pop for EpiPens, you know, is there a way to take something that's already approved on the marketplace? You're not trying to say get the breast pump approved, but you're focusing on one very narrow niche of like, hey, this is the equipment I'm going to provide, and we're going to provide a better service, whether it's to the consumer or to the doctor. And I think the real disruption here is sort of like kind of like Uber level disruption. Not that I'm saying Uber is good or bad, just how much they disrupted, say, like the New York City taxi markets, is like the way to find out how to get the EpiPen into the hands of the mom or the dad or whoever, you know, sort of around the doctor and the prescribing network, because of all the folks that either A, are on, high deductible plans, or B, just don't have insurance, or their insurance doesn't cover them carrying around an EpiPen.
There's a couple things I want to say about this, but first off, there's a tweet that I have pinned to the top of my account or my Twitter profile that talks about sort of my manifesto here. And I would argue that if anybody listening to this just goes and reads it, just replace Bump Health, the name of our company, with the name of your company and the industry that you're in. Because here's the thing, you know, not to pick on that company that you kind of mentioned, right? The one we saw in St. Louis, but here's the thing, like those guys were going directly into the industry. They were trying to build a new medical device, which is amazing. Good for them. Good for them. But what comes with that? Well, you have to cross a couple big moats and make sure you have enough investor dollars to back you on that. So in that particular case, they had to cross the moat of hardware design and manufacturing. They had to cross the moat of FDA registration and clearances. Then, if that wasn't enough, only then could they cross the moat of customer acquisition. You know, you can't go the other way when you're talking about medical devices. It's really hard. So where I want to go with this, though, with your question is that, you know, I never want to make this show about Bump. That's not the point. But I do want to keep using Bump as an illustrative example so listeners can apply it to their own company. So let me just get to the point. I think of diversification differently than most people. So, you know, one of your overarching questions here is not only what is DME, but why? Like, how are we going to do this? What in the world are we doing here, right? Here's the way I think about it. I find the histories of large companies like Procter & Gamble, Microsoft, and Cisco to be very fascinating. And just in a nutshell, here's what I'll say. Those companies, like most startups even today, started as product-centric companies. They started with one thing, and then they grew that one thing. So just illustrative example, let's use Microsoft. They started out with a DOS, the operating system. And I'm abridging the history for any of the history buffs here. You know, don't kill me. But the point is, they started with an operating system. They started putting it out on the hardware. They got a deal, for example, with IBM, put it on all the IBM machines. Now, all of a sudden, they have this realization. They're like, wait a second. So our product got us to this distribution that we've got, but now maybe we should start thinking of ourselves as a distribution-centric company and acquire more products to shove into that distribution channel. So what you and I know today, for example, as Microsoft Office, was not entirely built by Microsoft. I mean, a lot of components there were built internally, but also a lot of them were bought externally. So Microsoft and Cisco and Procter & Gamble, they are now distribution companies that happen to own a lot of products. So I guess that was a little rambly way of saying that every company, every startup starts as a product-centric company, and that's how you should start. But at some point, you have to realize that if you get to a certain level of traction, you should start to think about distribution as the primary focus of the company, and then acquire or build more products to shove into that distribution funnel. It's a big idea. It's probably hard for me to convey on a short podcast here, but when I think about DME, right? Again, let's just use Bump as an illustrative example. I believe the future belongs to the companies that control affinity groups. So I think, for example, most other e-commerce companies think of the first transaction as a way to get another transaction. That's okay. That's great. That's how they think about CAC and LTV. I think about it. I think about that for sure. But then I think about how do you go wider? How do you go wider? Like, how do you increase LTV much more rapidly? Well, the way you do it is you start to move into adjacent spaces because you already have the affinity group. So let's just use Bump one more time as an example. We acquire the mom into our consumer business at the point of conception. She buys a subscription box, or somebody gives her a subscription box to our, you know, to celebrate her pregnancy. And what happens is, like, you know, just like any other company, at the beginning, we just forced ourselves to grow the LTV by making the product better, you know, thinking about upsells, keeping the churn low, you know, and that's how we increased LTV. And we're going to keep doing that. That will always be part of the Bump consumer DNA. But then we stood up a separate business alongside it, or, you know, it's still owned by us, but, you know, this one is Bump Medical, and it's our DME business, but eventually it'll also contain our telehealth business and our pharmacy business. And because these moms need those things, she's owed a free breast pump in many cases. She's owed postpartum undergarments. And we can use, because we've already acquired the customer, we can sort of just feed that into that other business unit and let it kind of go. So anyway, I realize I'm rambling here, but I think this idea is applicable to a lot of other companies out there right now.
Yeah, I do as well. And I wonder, you know, unintentional segue, I wonder how, like, you'd frame something like this up in North Star. So, you know, are you tracking the waterfall effect of customers that were part of business A and are now part of business B? And I'll use, like, you know, the breast pump and the undergarments as the, you know, the Bump Medical as the business B.
Short answer is no. So those are two different things. So with North Star, we'll talk about that separately. That's really just a KPI dashboard. It's not smart. It's just a thing to kind of, like, save people time.
No, but isn't there a KPI you can track about customers that move
Correct.
From one to the
now,
other?
Correct.
So, in other words, you should there's a number you're tracking of, like, certain number of customers that you have in the core Bump business that have moved to another vertical.
Yeah. So let me answer your questions directly first, and then we'll talk about North Star if you like. But the truth is, today we do not clearly, like, I would be lying to you if I said, hey, if you said to me, Paul, what percentage of your Bump consumer customers are converting over into Bump Medical? I can't tell you that off the top of my head. It's in a spreadsheet somewhere. It's got a Google event, Google Analytics event defined somewhere. I could probably go dig it out. But today, we don't have one person thinking about the overall life cycle of mom across the businesses. We have people thinking about the CAC and LTV of a mom inside each of our businesses, but we're just now starting to spool up an overarching team that would start to think about, you know, the life cycle across the business units. It's very hard, by the way. I'll tell you, just because, like, the incentives are really hard to align. So, for example, I'm dealing with this right now because I'm doing a lot of recruiting. So, you know, for example, the person that runs email marketing in our consumer business, rightfully, her incentive, her goal on the scorecard is transactionality, right? Are your emails interesting enough to drive a subscription transaction? Mm-hmm. But the other person doing the similar job in our Bump Medical business is thinking about moms opting in to letting us be their patient advocate. Well, those two incentives are very different. And now, if you don't control that carefully, you know, because we're a big combined entity, is that I would be lying to you if I told you that, like, we definitely have situations where moms are not getting the right call to action at the right time because, like, we don't have anybody in an overarching position thinking about the life cycle.
No, I don't think it surprises me that you don't have someone who's quarterbacking across all the verticals, but I do think that, you know, for a company like yours to be successful, somebody does have to sort of wake up and go to sleep with the pain point of how many customers how many customers did we lose in conversion, you know, this week or this day, this whatever period. and what's that opportunity worth in the future? Because not only is it obviously a great way for you to accelerate Bump, but it's also the story that if you were seeking investment, it's the story you tell investors of why you need to bring in more capital, is because you see this opportunity and you now need to hire against it to be able to 10x it or 100x
Absolutely. I think the key idea I just want to make sure that people pick up on here is that, you know, you got to think about diversification a little bit differently. And that's like, I think it's interesting to go study how other large incumbent companies in other industries, you know, started as product-centric companies, but then made that shift to becoming a distribution-centric company. Like, we see ourselves as a mom acquisition company. We just happen to have a bunch of business lines. And you've heard me say this on the tech tour, like, you know, if you really do want to raise money, you're better off trying to sell yourself as a sales company that happens to be in the industry you're in, instead of what most people do. They say, I'm a tech company, I'm a blockchain company, you know, they almost imply that you can just bolt sales on later. That's just not the case.
I am the Uber of fill in the blank. How many times do we hear that over the course of 3 years?
Oh, boy.
Side note, don't tell that to an investor. All right. So you teased me before we hit the record button that there's something coming in Northstar that might work for me. But you didn't tell me what it was. So now you got to tell me.
Yeah. So there's a, should be an update that'll get automatically pushed out to everybody next week. But the, so first off, got a little over 3,000 users now. Great feedback. A lot of it harsh in a good way. You know, people are like, hey, why is everything hard-coded to dollars? I live in the EU. It's like, okay, that's fair. I'll fix it. But so what's coming in the short term that I hinted to you is that, you know, right now it hooks into your Google Analytics and pulls your e-commerce data. But for example, with your website, Ed, you don't have e-commerce enabled. You're not selling anything on your website. So Northstar is inherently useless to you. So there's going to be, in next week's release, you will be able to still use it for your traffic stats. Every time you open a new tab, you'll be able to see what your top four sort of metrics are for any web property in your Google Analytics account. So that'll be the first big change you'll see. There's a bunch of other polish items that are coming out next week. The following week, what we're going to do is start rolling out. I don't know why I just said we to make it sound bigger. But anyway, what's going to come out after that is Amazon Seller Central support. And then soon after that, Shopify. I need the Seller Central stuff. One of our distribution channels at Bump is Amazon, you know, the FBA stuff. And like, I don't know if you've ever done that, but God, the Seller Central platform is so impossible. I mean, it's just horrible. To find out how much you sold yesterday is like 17 clicks. It sucks.
Yeah. No, so, there's a whole slew of people that you've never met or never heard of that would be all over that Amazon Seller Central stuff. So you'll have to let me know when that's live and I'll turn over those people. You will see some of the weird, well, actually you can't see the stats, but if you could see the stats, you'd see some of the weirdest Seller Central data possible.
Oh, I can't. I mean, I don't even know if I want it. Even if I could, I don't want to see the data.
I think it's legal. It's people earning lots of miles and points, and they're doing it by buying and selling stuff. It's this entire reseller network. It's folks who buy pallets of stuff from Costco and have it shipped into the FBA arm of Amazon. It's a little bizarre.
Interesting. I mean, isn't it interesting? I mean, there's just so many ways to make money.
Oh, I have folks whose day job is whatever, a government contractor, and they're earning more money off of their quote unquote side hustle, like buying pallets of gear from places like Costco and reselling it online than they make in their day job. And it started really as just a way to earn more miles so they could travel. And then all of a sudden it turned into, you know, a six figure job.
Good for them. I mean, what are we?
Yeah.
It's like we're all working so hard.
Sorry, so I want to tee something up, and you and I started to talk about this before the show, and you know, it's like we talk about this so much on the tour. So setting this up, I, you know, obviously listen to a lot of other podcasts. One of the podcasts I listen to is the All In podcast. If folks aren't familiar, it's four investors that are all, you know, fairly well known in this space. And so this conversation was between two investors, David Freeberg and David Sachs. And I'm not going to, you know, get into sort of like opinionating on what I feel about their views. But the discussion was like Freeberg brought up the point that he thought it was hard for companies to grow at venture scale. And what he meant by that, paraphrasing what he said, was like, hey, you know, it's really hard to grow, you know, triple your revenue this year and then triple your revenue again next year for, you know, call it an effective 10x, if you will. And the theory there is like, you know, sure, there are a lot of companies that can triple their revenue this year. But then once you're at that much bigger number next year, can you then triple that number again? And, you know, and Sachs's comment back to him was, you know, I don't actually think that that's that hard. And, you know, I think the thing that irked me about it is I feel like there are a ton more total startups out there. We've had this conversation. There are a ton more startups out there right now than, you know, when I got back investing in startups again back in like 2008, 2009. But I don't necessarily think it's easier to get to 10x is the reason why we have more unicorns. I think we have lots of smart people in the space and there's lots of money chasing them, but I think it's sheer numbers. I still think overall, like taking something like, you know, Bump, like I think it's tough to grow to 10x. You're like, you need to be focused and tactical if you're going to grow, if you're going to 10x your revenue from any reasonable number.
Yes.
You know, if you had to guess across your portfolio, when you look at the numbers, how many people are effectively able to 10x a company, and what do you think the ones that aren't doing it, what do you think that they're missing? What's a key piece that's keeping them from doing it?
Well, let's start with the obvious part here, by the way, that the only people that really need 10x are, you know, the investors that have big funds under management. Yeah. Because those 10x companies are really the only way to go. But I think the more specific direct answer to your question is like, look, we all know that the vast majority of companies fail. It doesn't matter whether they're funded or not. We know that the vast majority of them fail. So the roundabout answer to your question is very few survive, and very, very few of those survivors ever can go 10x or even 2x. I mean, I keep saying to my team that our goal is to just 2x every year. Yeah. Now, look, I'd be lying if I didn't tell you that we sometimes miss that. You know, sometimes it's 1.3x for a year. Sometimes it's 2.7x, right? But that North Star, if you will, of just saying 2x, as we get bigger, it helps us understand what isn't going to move the needle. You know, when we started that first year, you know, maybe button color and button placement really mattered. You know, that could move the needle when you're going from, let's say, 100K to 200K or something like that. But, you know, like this year, we'll end up somewhere between 35 and 40 mil top line and still profitable. And that's great. But, you know, here we are, Q4 of 2021 recording this. And like a lot of my spare brain cycles go to, okay, I got to get us to 80 next year. What does that look like? You know, and that 2x sort of target tells me, or at least gives me the ability to like take things off the list that would not materially move the number to where we need it to be. Does that make sense?
Well, I think you bring up a great point about where you should be focusing, because it's not that those other things that you're talking about couldn't help grow the company, but they won't move the needle. And, you know, to the point that you said of companies that fail because they can't grow at these venture style rates. I think this also goes back to, as an entrepreneur, deciding what you want your company to be. And you say this so well when we're on the tour about how, like, once you take money from a VC, you're on the hamster wheel and they want that rapid growth. I think, you know, to that point, because it is hard to, you know, 3x and then 3x or to 10x in any of those situations, that there probably are a lot of folks who can grow at an incredibly high rate, but not at these exponential rates, that are probably better off bootstrapping or taking money from family and friends or things like that and setting the expectations correctly on what truly is success, and not necessarily shooting for the, like, you know, delaying the decision to fundraise until you've figured out if your funnel is actually big enough to 10x your revenue.
Yeah. I mean, I have so many thoughts. I don't even know how much time we have. So I don't want to like,
we've unlimited
I can ramble
time.
About this one, but well, but the listeners don't. I mean, look, here's the thing. you know, the older I get, the more cynical I become about chasing these 10x goals. You know, I, as an investor, certainly would like companies thinking about it as a 10x kind of thing, because from a portfolio theory standpoint, you know, I know that 90% of my companies will fail. So I need every one of them swing in for 10x so that I at least break even, you know, and you and I know how the venture math works. But as an operator, ah, man, that is just, it's hard enough to like just build sustain. Like, here's the point. I think sustainable 2x growth is way more attractive and way more attainable than sporadic 10x growth.
It's also a lot harder to raise on, though, I think, because the current model wants to see this hockey stick, whereas...
Oh, yes. You know, of course.
And you know, like, and you know me, like, I've always been, like, I'm the guy who's sitting in the corner going, but right, but when are you going to be profitable? Like, you know, looking at, like, the Ubers of the world. It's like, it's great to have all this growth, but when are you actually going to make money?
So, yes, you're right. If your goal is to raise money, yes, I understand the 2X is not very sexy. Now, there's a little caveat to that, by the way, that, you know, I am starting to see a lot of PE firms get really excited about, you know, bootstrapped companies that are doing, you know, let's call it 7 figures of EBITDA. You know, now I'm starting to see like multiples. It used to be that multiples on bootstrapped companies were very low. But, you know, at least in my little corner of the world, I'm starting to see PE firms coming in and offering 5 and 10x EBITDA on bootstrap companies, as long as you're in the 7 figures on that EBITDA line. So that's an interesting change recently. But back to your point, yeah, look, if you want to raise money, you got to sell the dream. You got to aim big, because that's what the investor's portfolio needs. And yeah, there's no, you know, there's no, there's nothing I could say to make you feel better about it. I think you just have to swing big. You have to aim for the right target markets. You have to have the right aggressive growth tactics and team. And it just gives me anxiety thinking about that, by the way, as an operator. Like, you know, maybe I'm just getting older.
Oh, we're definitely getting older. But, you know, when you think about companies that are trying to steal share, I think it's, you know, this goes back to something. And as you say, like, don't want to keep going back to bump, but I think it's a great example, because when we talk about things like Slack and Teams and all those other competing products, I think you can talk about, you know, which one is a company going to choose and how are they going to, you know, how are they going to make their decisions, and you're competing against a better product. But I think at the end of the day, you know, one of the comments that you made a lot on the tour gets back to, you know, the acquisition strategy for a lot of companies, which is you're not really competing, you know, with who you think you're competing with. You're competing with whatever pops up on their iPhone in the next 6 or 7 minutes. And are they still engaged? And so that's where, you know, when you talk about the difficulty in building 10X, it's like you can have a great growth strategy and something that has, you know, that you never saw coming, the, you know, the quote unquote black swan, you know, kills your ability to continue to grow. Not because somebody came out with a better product, but there's different mind share. I mean, I think a great example right now is when you look at, say, like the minimum wage hikes that are coming in all the fast food service businesses right now, that's taking time away from those operators doing something else. And in this case, I've seen a lot of companies that are coming out that are public companies right now who've said that they're missing earnings, where marketing expenses are up and average basket size, whether it's food or retail or whatever, is down. And I'm not sure this is 100% equivalency, but I got to say that, you know, if you're spending more time focusing on recruiting and getting the right people in place, you know, Mindshare says that, you know, if you're now your marketing costs skyrocket, you're paying more to try and bring in the next customer because now you're chasing this labor cost issue. And so, you know, the number of companies that are missing earnings based on weak sales growth tells me that it's this Mindshare issue of, as you say, like, if you don't grab mom's attention when the baby's down for a nap, is she really going to look at whatever bump has to offer until the next time she has mind share to look at it? And I think a lot of companies lose that battle.
Yeah. So this is a big one. And this is, you know, one of the biggest levers that caused some of this stuff is iOS 14 and, you know, what it did to the paid targeting, paid acquisition channels for a lot of companies. But you're also right that it's also a war for attention. It's always been a war for attention, you know, not only, so if you look at if you think about what the challenges are today, you know, here we are, end of 2021 almost, right? you could summarize it very simply by saying that the number of other distractions or other things that are on your customer's mind is increasing by the day, right? Whether it's for competitors, they're thinking about competitors or their kids or their families or work or whatever, but also your ability to target has diminished as a company. You know, your paid channels.
Significantly.
Significantly. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm seeing CAC doubled across the portfolio since April when the rollout happened. I think one of the topics we should talk about next week is what I call bump media, but I think an illustrative example that a lot of other entrepreneurs can apply to their own businesses and to their own careers.
Yeah. And I think, you know, to your point about the iOS targeting and how that's affected things. And we talked a bit about it last week in the episode, you know, to illustrate another example that you and I were talking about offline that really, I think, gets at the heart of how this is affecting large companies is, you know, Peloton had a pretty significant miss in their earnings. And it was sort of across the board. Marketing costs way up, number of units sold down, just a bunch of different things. And to sort of drill down to call it a personal level, watching the World Series, and there were a number of Peloton commercials. Those aren't as expensive as Super Bowl ads, but they're run over a larger period of time. And that wasn't something that Peloton was doing before. And so like if this quarter comes out and you tell me that the numbers are killing it and they're pushing out treadmills and bikes like crazy, and then they decide that they're going to do some Super Bowl ads or some World Series ads, like that story kind of makes sense to me. I've never been a huge fan of that sort of like mass media and that like if your brand's big enough, I don't necessarily think you need to remind people during the World Series or the Super Bowl. But to your point of like Peloton spending so much more money on marketing right now, and they're moving less units than they want to, where those ads used to appear in my feed all the time, Instagram, Facebook, you know, there was always Peloton ads, always sponsored content for that stuff. And clearly it doesn't seem like that's happening now with the targeting restrictions in the new iOS. And so a big company like Peloton takes this big, big hit trying to pivot to keep that funnel robust.
Yes. And, you know, I know we're probably running a little long in this episode and we should probably wrap, but I would say that, look, here's the thing. This problem that you're defining is equally affecting everybody. But I would say the impact of it is probably disproportionately affecting the little guys. So the Pelotons of the world have enough capital to sort of work themselves through it and find maybe some new channel or method to acquire the attention. But I might be misquoted here or misquoting myself here, but like, you know, when I read sort of the public earnings reports from Facebook, you know, yeah, there's a lot of big spenders on the paid side of their revenue. A lot of the volume is actually made up of like millions of little players, and it's those customers. So it'll be interesting to see how the paid sort of world resets itself over the next couple months. Again, CAC has doubled across the portfolio for me, and that's not surprising. I think, by the way, if you're looking into this, it's probably only going to get worse. Because it's only a matter of time before, you know, Google does the same thing on Android. I don't think it's a question of if, it's going to be when. And when that happens, you're going to see CAC go up even further. So again, I think one of the big things we should talk about next week is going to be this idea of like, what do you do? I've got some thoughts and some early bets we're making. But I'll be curious to see what you think about it.
No, I think that's a great thing for us to tee up for next week. And I think you bring up a great point about how, you know, the Pelotons of the world have enough cash in the bank to take a big swing at readjusting their CAC and their channels, where the small folks sort of fall into these two categories of either they don't have enough cash or they don't see enough return. And so they just decide that they're going to sit that game out and figure something else out. What that something else is remains to be seen. It's redefining this CAC landscape. We had a couple other things on the list that we didn't get to. I still hope that we get a chance to have the DoorDash Uber Eats discussion at some point, because those companies still confound the hell out of me. I still haven't figured out what who's going to make money in those things, but that'll be a good one for us to tackle at some point in the future, as well as, you know, really trying to dig into this tactical piece on on how companies should be thinking about acquiring customers in this new world. Because you're right, Google's gonna make this shift. Maybe they don't make it exactly the same way Apple does, but the writing's on the wall at this point, and it's time to get ahead of it.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely. Well, isn't that normal though? We start out with a list of like 10 interesting ideas, and then we sort of really focus in on three. That's great. That means we're having fun, right?
I think we are. And for folks who have listened this far, do us a favor and leave us a 5-star review or a rating wherever you're listening to the show. We'd love that. And also shoot us some questions. Social media, he's at Paul Singh. I am at Pizza in Motion on ye olde Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can email us show@resultsjunkies.com and hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening so you can get the new episodes as soon as they drop. What's on your agenda next week, man?
I'm going on vacation. A long-needed vacation with Dana, no kids.
Nice.
We are just going to relax and recharge and come on back and hit the ground on the offense.
I like it. I like it. Well, cool. Well, I hope.
How about you? Are you traveling at all? Or?
Well, by the time we record again, we will have finished a Disney fundraiser. We're going to go down and raise some money for a charity called Give Kids the World that houses all the Make-A-Wish kids down there. So we're gonna go do a little Disney ride challenge and try and raise $10,000 or $20,000 to help some kids get their dream trip. That's our
awesome.
Goal, and it should be in the books by the next time you and I record.
Love it. Can't wait to hear all about it.
All right, man. Well, we'll check in next week.